Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Curtis Sherwood, and I appear here today on behalf of the appellant, City and County of Honolulu, in this matter. As this court is aware, a reviewing court such as this one ordinarily gives great deference to the verdicts rendered by juries, particularly where a trial has gone through to completion. However, this court nevertheless has a unique and important and integral role in ensuring that verdicts are just, that they are not premised purely on sympathy or other emotion, but have some evidential basis which supports the legal claims presented. Your Honors, the city asserts that the incident case is that extraordinary case in which the trial record is lacking when it comes to such evidentiary basis. It asserts that there is not substantial evidence to support the jury's verdict. Rather, in three important respects, the trial record is insufficient to justify the verdict reached. First and foremost, as the court's aware, we're dealing with a Title VII claim, and plaintiff did not prove a causal link between her 1997 earlier Title VII case and the actions taken against her in 2005. As we pointed out in our brief,
you know, the district court, you know, Judge Edwards was a very experienced trial judge, and Judge Edwards said, okay, this is a pretty weak case.
He did, Your Honor.
But he let it go to the jury. And then you renewed your motions after the jury verdict, right?
We did, Your Honor.
And Judge Ezra rejected again, having seen all the witnesses, having lived with this case for a long time, because there were a lot of points of this. There were a lot of arguments made that were dismissed before they ever got to trial. So what mistake did Judge Ezra make?
Well, he made a number of mistakes, Your Honor, but I think the one that's most glaringly obvious is the fact, if you read his opinion, he mentions that the relevant period, he takes essentially plaintiff's word for the law as to what the relevant period was with regards to retaliation.
What do you mean by it?
As far as implying some sort of retaliation, simply from the context. This was a pure circumstantial case, Your Honor. And
well, it wasn't a pure circumstantial case in the sense that her testimony included being yelled at about the lawsuit and being told, you know, don't talk to me, I don't want to talk to you, don't ever talk to me because you put forward this lawsuit. So there's some direct testimony about hostility that is here that's a little bit beyond mere timing, but even timing is inferentially permissible, isn't it?
It is, Your Honor, under certain circumstances. I think the episode that Your Honor is referring to actually occurred in 1997 involving Chief Correa. And I apologize, our citations in our opening brief are not the best. But that incident involving who then Major Correa was essentially the reason that Major Correa was brought into that original sexual harassment lawsuit.
Right, but then in 2004, it seems that Lima, I think is the name of the person who was the supervisor, did have some knowledge of the prior suit also and knew Correa.
He was aware of it. He knew Correa being an officer there, a high-ranking officer at the police department. But Lima, the trial record really isn't specific in what they're alleging that Lima did. Really, what the grievance is that the plaintiff is making is the fact that she was criminally prosecuted and that they followed the ROPA procedure with her, which is a removal of police authority. So pursuant to that, she was transferred out of the job that she was in. She was required to tender her vehicle and her cell phone.
And wasn't there also testimony that she was given somewhat more onerous tasks, like having to complete mileage logs that she didn't used to have to do and things along those lines, that her day-to-day life was also made more difficult than it had been?
That's the one and only example I can recall, Your Honor, about the mileage logs.
Well, why couldn't a jury, taking all of that together, even though it's a weak case, say, well, it's weak, but we're persuaded that it's a fair inference, a reasonable inference from everything that happened?
I think it's too weak, Your Honor, to constitute an adverse employment action just simply to state that she had to complete mileage logs that she did previously. I think the real harm is that the
prosecution, among other things.
That's the real harm, Your Honor, is the prosecution. And as I tried to point out in our briefs, appellee's counsel, or intervener, actually, harped on this time and time again in their closing argument, the fact that she was subject to a criminal prosecution. And I really feel that's what the jury was compensated.
What's wrong with that? What's wrong with pointing out that that was her, in fact, that was her claim? That's what she's complaining about.
Well, Your Honor, I would assert that there was probable cause for that. And if we take that tack, then basically you're going to be impeding any sort of criminal prosecution in the future with anyone. You're giving a blank check to anyone that's ever filed a successful Title VII claim.
Well, that's not all she showed. You spoke a minute ago about the ROPA policy. I think that's the right acronym.
Yes.
Wasn't there testimony that, or evidence introduced one way or another, that that policy was not always followed?
I don't recall that, Your Honor. I was not trial counsel, but reviewing the record, I don't recall that as being part of the record. I believe in most cases it's followed. I believe it's in all cases followed, as far as I know, Your Honor.
I'll double check the record, but that's not what I have in my notes. But setting that aside, the other I would like to get back to your other comments about the circumstantial evidence of causation, because I recall from the record that the chief testified that he didn't make this decision to refer the case for investigation.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
But his subordinate testified that he did make the final decision, and the jury heard that testimony, correct?
That the subordinate made the decision, not the chief, Your Honor. The only manner in which the chief was involved was his name on a form memorandum,
right,
which the deputy chief signed off.
I think we're saying the same thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right.
So the chief really didn't play a role in any of the so-called administrative or adverse employment actions that took place.
Well, he said that he recused himself, but he is also the one who said that he's placed her on administrative leave for 3 days, right?
I believe so.
And required her to return her car?
Yes.
And transferred her to the records division?
Correct.
Thank you.
With respect to the prosecution, what's the problem here? Is this an argument that the jury would have had to have found that there was no probable cause for that? Are we arguing about the jury instructions? What's the city's?
That's part of it, Your Honor, and we have argued that there should be an additional element to be proven for a retaliation case where the retaliation is a criminal prosecution based on that Hartman-Bivens case. But in addition to that, the prosecution was...
Because Hartman is a Bivens case, right? And this is not a 1983 action.
It's
not a constitutional argument. So how do you get from Hartman to a Title VII case?
Well, you're still dealing with retaliation, Your Honor. And whether the retaliation is proper or not, whether the retaliation is based on probable cause or whether it's some nefarious form of retaliation, whether the prosecution is based on
probable cause. Is this a failure to instruct the jury properly? Is that the problem? That the district court didn't instruct them that they would have to find there was a lack of probable cause for the prosecution?
Yes, Your Honor.
Did you request that?
We did not, Your Honor.
Okay, so it's now a plain error case.
That is a plain error.
Okay, and it's plain error based on Hartman?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, but Hartman, again, is a Bivens case, not a Title VII case. So do you have a Title VII case that would suggest that there's plain error here?
I don't, Your Honor.
Okay, since there's a bit of a leap there and the city didn't find it itself, why was it that Judge Zedra was supposed to figure this one out all by himself or suffer reversal from us?
Well, I think the prosecution itself should have set off alarm bells for the court. The fact that there was this independent...
It didn't set it off for the city.
Not at that point.
That's always the problem with the plain error argument, isn't it, counsel?
It
is. Pretty tough.
It is. But, you know, we do have the fact that the grand jury made this separate determination of probable cause and that there was sufficient facts for that determination. So I think, as the Supreme Court emphasized, where you have that, you have some circumstantial evidence of good faith.
Then are you suggesting then that the district court should have instructed the jury not to consider the prosecution as part of the retaliation package?
The problem is, Your Honor, is that the trial court let these malicious prosecution claims go all the way through to the end.
But it pretty much would have come in anyway, wouldn't it? I mean, as a practical matter, that you were talking about the whole package here, you might not have had those specific claims tried, but surely the fact of the prosecution would have been admissible evidence at some point in this trial.
I think we would have tried to keep it out, Your Honor. If the malicious prosecutions were not there, we would have asked.
But nobody asked that the jury be instructed that the jury not take into account the prosecution as part of the retaliation case.
That's correct.
And that's plain error on the part of the district court?
Well, Your Honor, they're all lumped together as far as that. Yeah.
We're now at a point where if you didn't request a specific jury instruction on that point, you've got to be able to say that the district court committed plain error.
Correct.
And that's not even Hartman, is it?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So do you have any case that should have informed Judge Ezra that he had a duty to instruct the jury that they were not to consider the prosecution of Ms. Black as part of the retaliation case?
No, Your Honor. Nevertheless, Your Honor, I still think, still assert that there's insufficient grounds for causation here. And I'd like to point out some instances in the record that I did mention. As I mentioned, the administrative and criminal investigations were initiated pursuant to the ROPA, which even the district court acknowledged applies fairly regularly, for example, in police shooting cases. We have testimony that Ms. Kamahele was not influenced by anyone named in plaintiff's earlier lawsuit. That's at our excerpts 269, 13-18. We have evidence that a policy, that the investigations were conducted pursuant to HPD policy that mandated that all complaints be investigated. That's at our excerpts 284 to 285, 12 through 4. And that the administrative actions taken, those the transfer, the surrender of the vehicle, the all of those things, not only did Chief Kajiyama make that decision, it was not the chief's decision, but he did so after consulting with the city's Equal Opportunity Officer, the Department of Corporation Counsel, HPD's legal advisor, the labor relations specialist of HPD, the major of HPD's Human Resources Division, and another deputy chief, all with to ensure that the course of action taken was fair, impartial, and consistent with its ROPA policy.
Counsel, you have about a minute and a half if you'd like to save some rebuttal time.
I'll do that. Thank you.
Good morning. In my short career, I've come to conclude.
Could you introduce yourself for the record?
Mark Beatty, intervener and former attorney for Sharon Black.
Thank you.
In my short career doing retaliation work, I've come to the conclusion that the sine qua non of a retaliatory fire is that the defendants are practiced liars. And addressing the comment that Judge Ezra made orally, that this is a weak case, I would say that supports my contention that the defendants are practiced liars, and they have a strategy, and they had a plan, and they set up Ms. Black. The one of the things before the court is additional hours because I went to two seminars. There are outlet seminars. I went and practiced my case, this case, before a bunch of colleagues and instructors, and another one before three groups of people, a mock jury, and got feedback. And the feedback I got from the mock jury and the experienced attorneys is that, well, the big factual point that I could prove very convincingly, and I think I do in page 839 of my opening brief, I think I have like 17 references to my excerpts. And over and over again, her whole career, she started this program. And from the beginning, her practice throughout the whole program is part of her job was to get statistics from the MEO, Medical Examiner's Office, and write up reports. And why that's an essential part of her job is that officers would take people with mental problems, and instead of just using the judicial system, they would take them to a medical facility, and Ms. Black would facilitate them getting an alternate form of help. Now, some of those people, when they were taken to the hospital, a day later, they ended up in the medical examiner's office dead. Now, that's a serious problem for her whole program. And again, 8 and 9, I go through excerpts of reference over and over again saying that this was her job all the way along. And she needed to know if the worst case scenario happened. And the only way to know that is to go to the medical examiner's office, research the suicides, see if anyone was from her population, that it was her job to help. And she did this for like 10 years. And there's multiple reports. Lieutenant Harada, who testified very, that's direct evidence he had. He says, of course it was her job. It was well known that it was her job. And her job description was in her central file available to everyone. And this is someone who worked with her. And this is someone who wrote all the hand notes. Again, 8 through 9, I list those, and a bunch of other places in my opening brief. And so, and that's the famous sticky note that I'm gonna find a reference for the sticky note. Where he says, I want more research for the next 6 months, suicides over the next 6 months. And boy, that's a direct thing. He says, go to the only place where you could go and get information on this, and do what you've been doing for the last 10 years, and write it up. Oh, and here's a deadline, we all want it, and we all got a lot of other things we're doing, but you got your job, you understand it? Okay, go do your job. I believe it's on Exhibit 41, around page 1,000, my excerpt record starts at 1,000, so 1,665 is that particular one. And this is why I think this whole appeal is subject to Rule 38 sanctions, because it was never my job to disprove that someone told her not to do it, or told her to go. That's most of the decision. Say, is there someone who orders you to go down there at this certain time, this certain thing? No, it's her job she's been doing for 10 years.
Counsel, could I ask a question that's completely off subject? Forgive me, but it's in my notes and I wanted to make sure you had a chance. My notes show that the record at 1366 shows that the ROPA policy was not always followed. Is that correct? Was there evidence to that effect?
And
I'm going to have a related question.
1366?
Right. I'm not so concerned if I've got the right citation to the record. I want to know whether or not there was a testimony before the jury that the ROPA policy was not always followed, but it was in this case. Is that right?
Your Honor, my impression is that came up.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be candid that looking at a lot of times in analogous situations where someone in the situation were not subject to ROPA, That wasn't part of my legal strategy. I didn't have
I think you've answered my question. So now my follow-up question is, does the ROPA policy apply to civilians like Black or just to people who are part of the police department? Was there evidence about that?
My knowledge from deposing a dozen or so people in the police system, yes, definitely. It applies to any employee. So a police officer, obviously, if they're on ROPA, they're turning in their weapon also. Ms. Black didn't have a weapon. But
so you don't contest that ROPA applied to Ms. Black? That's my question.
In theory, at least, as a civilian non-officer. Is that what you're getting at?
That's what I'm trying to figure out. What did the jury hear? Was that a contested issue at trial?
Your Honor, it might be very unusual that they applied it to civilian.
Counsel, I'm just asking a really clear question, and I just want to know whether the jury heard, was there a dispute about its applicability at trial? Did the jury hear a dispute?
That was not part of my legal strategy, and I had no witnesses directly to bring that.
Thank you. Thank you, Judge Graber.
Counsel, I've got a question that's even more off the beaten path than Judge Kristen's.
Good luck.
This case comes to us in a very unusual posture because you are representing yourself here only and not your former client.
Can I disagree with you? Is that I want her jury to win, and in that I want the same as.
I understand that. Okay. I understand. You have two things. As I understand it, you have two things at issue here. You have roughly about $92,000 in attorney's fees for yourself that are at issue here.
Yes.
And then you have some contractual share of any jury verdict if it's upheld in
yes.
your favor. Okay. What will the city be obligated, in your view, what would the city be obligated to pay here? Are they obligated to pay the full amount of her, of the verdict that she was awarded? And if so, where does the difference go?
Right. And, Your Honor, I filed, the court asked for information on that. And there's two things that I did to give information to the court. I contacted a lawyer that has to do with something to do with Sharon's estate. He didn't give me much information. I gave him a lot of information about this case, and the court required information about where that money would go to be submitted.
Well, wouldn't it normally go to her estate?
And that's exactly what I argue. I argue that money. So about that person who's dealing with some things of hers, he declined to be involved in this. He didn't want to. And so I say go to her estate, and since she does not have a will, it would just transfer via state intestate laws, so it would end up going to her two children.
Okay, so your view is that the whole $150,000, if we were to affirm the judgment, the whole $150,000 should be awarded anyway, and the state intestacy laws will figure out how to distribute the difference between the $150,000 and your percentage of it.
And I had a contractual of one-third, yes.
But the estate hasn't substituted in, right? The personal representative has
right,
not substituted
in. Right, and he specifically told me, and I put this on the, I think it's May 12, 2012, seven-page filing. I talked about the conversation we had, and he said that, well, he thinks that being a representative in court is beyond his authority. And he declined. I sent him like 8 emails with things about the case, attachments about the case. So he was well informed about that. I want to talk about jury instructions. It talks about several things relevant to this course. There's a lot of talk about requiring something on probable cause. I believe Judge Biden. Judge Bybee brought up the issue, how would the judge have known if it wasn't brought up, and there's no clear case law that even opposing counsel could think of right now. So there, in the notice, there is nothing specifically about jury instructions. Of course, in the notice of appeal, it referred to the order of Judge Ezra to their renew motion for a judgment as a matter of law. And he talks about jury instructions a lot in there. And in their mediation statement, they say, oh, by the way, and they add on jury instructions, they add on MSJ, all these things they added on that they didn't put in their notice.
But counsel, you've lost me. Forgive me. I understood Jabaibi to be asking about the jury instruction that was given, and why would we expect the trial court judge to have instructed the jury about this theory, this Bivens theory? That's what I thought he was asking it.
Right. And my point about that is that the whole issue of insufficient jury instructions was not properly noticed. However,
on appeal,
later on,
are you talking? Using the word notice. You're talking about notice on appeal.
According to Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure, Rule 3, paragraph.
But counsel, that's what's confusing me. Forgive me, but I understood the question to be going to what happened in the trial court. Did I misunderstand the question? The question that I've got, anyway, has to do with why was it incumbent upon the trial court judge to give such an instruction to the jury if the city did not request it?
And my point, that whole issue isn't properly before the court because it was not properly noticed. Also, the whole issue of Judge Ezra making an error on a motion for summary judgment isn't properly before this court. I wrote for Rule 38 sanctions, and city answered excessively late. I did the 21-day notice, and I actually gave him like 2 or 3 months time to change things. So I met all the requirements of Rule 11 also, and they're excessively so it's questionable about any arguments they have for Rule 11, Rule 38 sanctions. If they could make that before this court, because they missed those deadlines. So that point I have is that there's serious failures of the city to meet deadlines and to meet the rules, and those three things I mentioned, I believe, are not properly before this court. And that's why, again, I maintain that this is a frivolous appeal, and what I thought would happen actually did happen, and it caused a lot of hardship on Ms. Black, and she's not here. April 5th, she passed away. So about notice, insufficient notice, that was that point. I want to just touch on one argument about the official versus equitable life risk multiplier, about the risk multiplier. Now, the 61-page order that the magistrate judge filed, it talked a lot about my hours. It reduced my hours from like 1,100 down to like 600, I believe it was. So 53% of the hours that I submitted. And a lot of justification, a lot of reasoning. I argued about two categories. One is the means I went to consult with much more experienced attorneys to just achieve that practice and insight that they have that you can only get from someone who's been practicing for 20 or 30 years.
Counsel, you have used up your time. And we understand your arguments. We've read the briefs, and nothing that you haven't said is waived or forfeited by not raising it orally.
Just thank you for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Sherwood, you have just shy of a minute and a half left.
I don't know that I'll need all that time, but I'll try to make use of some of it. First, I would object to any of opposing counsel's assertions concerning what was or was not in a mediation statement. That's not properly before the court, and frankly, it's improper to cite anything in that. I'd like to go back to the causation argument, which is the central and most important argument to our appeal. I think I mentioned some of the evidence that the court has before it, but I also mentioned that the plaintiff herself testified that she had no knowledge that anyone involved in her 1997 lawsuit directed the medical examiner's office staff to get her into trouble. And she also, there was no evidence that Chief Correa or Deputy Chief Kajiyama colluded with the Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Christopher Van Marder, and he himself testified that this was a decision he made on his own and was not influenced by anyone else. I did note in our reply that plaintiff and intervener in his brief cited for the court a number of cases that state where such a long period has elapsed that we have here, like 8 years. I think he actually has some cases citing 10 months, is not sufficient in and of itself.
Counsel, you also have exceeded your time, so if you can have a sentence to wrap
it's,
up.
It's,
if you
it's
like.
Simply not sufficient. I think they're missing the point. There has to be some causation between these two elements, and there simply was not one demonstrated. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. Before you sit down, I would like to direct the same question to you that I addressed to Mr. Beatty concerning what we do with this unusual procedural posture with the death of Ms. Black and the refusal of her personal representative to enter the suit. If we assume for purposes of my question that we were to affirm the judgment, yes, then there would be both an attorney's fee award to Mr. Beatty, and then in the city's view, what happens to the $150,000 judgment the jury awarded to Ms. Black?
I think it goes to her estate.
Okay, so go to her estate, and then Mr. Beatty can deal with the estate on any contractual claim that he has.
Correct. I'm not certain, however, though, that the attorney's fees award is properly the property of the intervener. I believe it's actually the property of this. It should be the property of the estate.
Why would an award of attorney's fees be the property of the estate?
I believe there's case law on it. I may have cited it in one of the numerous filings dealing with attorney's fees.
Your view then is that some $242,000 would then go to the estate?
Yes,
and then Mr. Beatty should talk to the estate?
Correct.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The case just argued is submitted. We thank both counsel.